All right, if the clerk will please announce counsel.
May it please the court, Mr. Brenton Muscle White to argue for the appellant, and Mr. Brian Davis to argue for the appellee.
All right, thank you. Mr. Muscle White.
Check this color code, because I got in one court a little different one time. Thank you, Your Honor. I'm sorry about my voice. I had a kind of an emergency for a client in Houston yesterday, so I was late getting here. And, Your Honor, I'm glad you were late, because it gave me time to get ready as I can. And I appreciate the opportunity to appear before you. It's always good to be in Fort Worth. What I want to do is go right to the point here. We've got, in this case, I feel like I kind of had the double whammy, because at the same time that we couldn't, there was no finding, or there wasn't, it had not been located, that's what everybody said, and or if it had, the local natives had taken off parts of the aircraft. We also have the fact that the court would not let us take depositions of the defendants. And that's, I've been practicing law a very long time, longer than a lot of people. And I've never had that happen before. I've never had a court say you can't take the depositions of your opposing party.
Well, now, wait a minute. I read the motion to quash and motion for sanctions, and it was a lengthy titled motion. And it had numerous reasons that they objected to you taking these depositions as they were noticed, including not following the local rules. They said you didn't properly serve them, et cetera, et cetera. So we don't exactly know from this standpoint why the trial court, in your words, didn't let you take the depositions. Actually, I think it quashed the deposition notices that you had sent out as they were proffered and noticed and so forth. So I didn't get the perception that you weren't allowed to. I got the perception that the trial court sustained their objection or sustained their motion to quash or whatever. And then so how do you respond that you didn't, to their assertion, I'm not saying it's true, to their assertion that you didn't try to address their objections and take the depositions again?
Well, Your Honor, what we did is I think we had a hearing July, and the order that came down saying sustaining their position came down, I believe, in August.
Right.
And at the hearing, it was clear that I don't think that, I'm not saying what the court said in terms of why he based what he had for a basis for a ruling, except to say that I think and what they put in their motion were several reasons. You're right, and it could have been any one or more of those reasons, but the effect of it was that with us trying to find the wreckage or get a handle on getting the wreckage, and with us trying to figure out what our cause of action was, to be very honest with you. I mean, we felt like we had a cause of action, but getting the evidence was our problem. When the court said, you can go to Indonesia, take depositions there, but you can't take in depositions of the defendants here. And that was kind of the words he used. I don't know if he used it verbatim, but it was not as if he were basing it on some little problem here of notice or not giving them a chance to ask for a new date. It wasn't convenient for him or anything like that. It was a fact. He said, go to Indonesia, take depositions there. And here we were. This was in 2010. And the case had come back. I think the court probably aware of the history. We spent 6 years going back and forth, ping-ponging back and forth between Texas and Indonesia. But when we finally got the forum nonconvenience matter resolved and the court accepted reestablishment of the cause of action in his court, then we spent about a year going back and forth. And when we got down to this hearing in July 10th, I think, right after the 4th of July, we knew that we had to get going somehow or another, and plaintiffs did. And when the court said, go to Indonesia, I'm not going to let you take the, this is the way I heard it, take the depositions of the defendants at this point. I don't think any judge says it's forever. He didn't say forever. But I knew we had to try to do something about the situation in Indonesia. And we felt like that probably that's where a lot of the facts did lie. And so we started working on that. Now, what took so long there, and I know that's in your mind, it took about a year for us to get it all together and go to Indonesia. There are a lot of reasons for that. I say some of it was partly their fault. Some of it, we just had trouble getting things. It was very difficult to deal. You can't compel people down there. You have to talk to them. And my local counsel, Rudy Irwin, did a magnificent job, but he was just struggling. And then the defendants wrote a letter saying they would like, before we got some of the wreckage that was down in a ravine, and I hoped that it would be part of the wreckage that had to dealt with the power train, but turned out not to be. But in any event, in order to do that, they wanted us to get permission from three different groups in Indonesia. And I didn't say they say you've got to do that before we come, but they said that's what we think you should do. We cannot be certain that we can have a right to look at any of this wreckage in the ravine unless you get the permission. Well, we started working on that. That took 2 to 3 months that we worked on that. Finally, I called counsel and said we've got to go. We just have to go because we're running out of time. The case is set for trial on November the 2nd. So we did finally go last week in September, first week of October, and we took the depositions. And we were able, in my humble opinion, to develop a viable cause of action that dealt with a power train, the failure of the power train, the gearboxes more specifically. And there at those depositions we took 8 or 9 depositions, I don't know the exact count, maybe 10. In any event, we took a guy by the name of Minarno testified, and he testified, and I didn't know about this until we got there. But, I mean, I didn't think he was going to be much of a relevant witness, but it turned out to be very relevant because he testified that he talked to his brother-in-law, who was was a co-pilot. And the brother-in-law said to him that we got problems with the gearboxes. And then the brother-in-law, we had a testimony of another young lady who was, I think, the daughter of one of the sisters, if I'm not mistaken. I don't know the exact relationship, but she had also talked to the same co-pilot, and he said, we've got a problem with the gearboxes, both the 2 days before the crash and the day before the crash. Now, that gave us some idea about what may have really happened. But I'd like to go back a minute, if I may, to the fact that what happened about 5 or 6 years prior to that, and that's when Bell Helicopter had this joint venture with ITPN in Indonesia. And it was not a joint venture to manufacture helicopters, as you might think of, but solely to assemble. And so when we were doing the form nonconvenience phase of the case, we took the deposition of one of the Bell witnesses, and our deposition was limited to form nonconvenience matters, but as you know, when you get into who's doing what and the law that applies to that, it sometimes gets relevant to the form nonconvenience determination. And so we got into a little bit of the relationship. We come to simply find out that he had gone down there ready to shut down the deal. They were supposed to assemble 100 helicopters, and they'd only assembled 25. He got down there and said, I think he was down there for quite some time, based on his testimony, if I recall it correctly. And we worked and worked, and we did everything that we could to try to get this thing to work out, and not a single one of those 25 helicopters could we get safe. Could they comply with FAA or the Bell's own?
But that assumes that was the problem that caused the crash, and there's no evidence because they were all taken off and sold by the villagers.
I'm sorry?
But I said that assumes assembly was the problem, but we can't tell that because we don't have any metal parts because they were all hauled off of the villagers.
Well, that was what some people said, they were hauled off by the villagers. Those things, because as our witness said in deposition, one of them weighs 700, the other weighs 900 pounds. I can't think of many villagers going to be able to cart those off, but what we think happened, but I admit, Your Honor, without being able to take further depositions, we couldn't prove it, based on some indications from an expert that my prior counsel in the case had hired. He went over there, and the Bell people were there. He wrote back, sent back, and that's in the evidence, that the Bell people, and I guess it could have been the local Bell person. He didn't say who. It could have been somebody from over here. But anyway, we're there. And then, but he said, I'm going to get this guy, and I think his deposition is in the record, and I'll get his name out in a minute, but Jerry Wells. And so Jerry Wells was a friend of his, and Jerry Wells was an expert, did work for Bell at one time, I believe. In any event, this expert that had been hired by Provost Humphrey, the firm that had the case, the lead of the case before I got involved as lead counsel, called Mr. Wells and said, I've got the powertrain, not the powertrain, but got the, I think he said engine or parts, and I need some help. Can you come over and help me?
I think what the brief says was that he asks for help.
That's right.
And the experts assumed he must have the parts.
That's his.
He didn't say he had the parts.
He didn't say what he had. That's true, Your Honor. But he had what he had. What we are arguing that the implication is that because of the way the situation was, he must have been referring, we believe, to part of some of the engine, some of the powertrain, or some part of it, the transmission, whatever, or the gearboxes. But he didn't say, he did not mention what he was referring to. That's true. But anyway, the fact that he then didn't call back and disappeared on Provost Humphrey and everybody else, as far as we know, it raised a flag there. And we've always felt like that at least, and if you'd read, Your Honors, I have them here, and I think it's in the record. In fact, I know they're both in the record. Both of the affidavits of Arthur Childers, and particularly the second affidavit. In the second affidavit, he talks about what they normally do in a case of a crash such as this one. And when you put on top of that the problems they had with the whole situation down there, and it finally shut it down, and of course it's our argument is that it was negligence per se not to recall as one of the parties to the joint venture, not to recall those remaining helicopters that had not been already dismantled or not in use, because when they left, they shut down there. They left several helicopters still in use, including this one, and it crashed. And it crashed before one of the crew said, he said he was having problems with the gearboxes. But in any event, we feel like there's some smoke there, whether there's fire there, we don't know. And I have to admit that. But what my point is that we, I've got to watch my time. But my point is that we have, we needed those depositions, not only for the development of the negligence part or product liability portion of the case generally, but to find out where that wreckage is, because we still believe it's just would not be, and a lot of the people down there agree with us, that would not be common sense for the people to walk in, and they would take parts, yes, but to take something that weighed 700 pounds, 900 pounds, no. So we think there's a very serious damage from the fact that we were not able at first, at least there's no, it's clear that as those depositions we noticed before we got off on the tack of trying to go to Indonesia, we wanted to talk to, and if you recall, it talked about the person with the most knowledge of both the design, the manufacturer, and the people who did the investigation. And if we'd gotten that, those depositions, we feel like we'd have gotten down the road. But we feel like it was not, it was error for the court at that point to deny us the POP, the right to take those depositions. Then the second point is, of course, whether or not the court erred in the not granting the short continuance that we asked for. If you look at the framework of this whole thing, it's only about a year. You know, when we had finally had that showdown hearing in July of 10, to the time that we came down and went down to Indonesia and took depositions, there was a year lapse in there. So it was really a little over a year, about 2 months over a year. So really there wasn't a lot of time. That's the framework for this case, basically. That's when we got down to the business, well, you're not going to take the depositions, at least we interpreted as such, maybe erroneously, but that's the way we interpreted. Not going to take the depositions of the, and you're wasting time to try to take the depositions of the Bell people, so going down to Indonesia, I've given you the right to go down there if you pay $10,000 to the other side for their expenses. He didn't put a number on it, just said pay their expenses, and that's what we had to pay.
All right, Mr. Musselwhite, your time has expired. Okay.
And I'll just say, I'll go into a little bit of it on rebuttal, but
okay.
Just want to say that the last issue, which was about the question of, let's see, we had I wanted to say about it. I'll just wait and say it on rebuttal.
All right, thank you. All right, we have Mr. David.
And I apologize, I've had what doctors refer to as the crud for the past 5 days, so
it's going around.
You messed up. My name is Brian David. I represent Bell Helicopter in this litigation, and I'm assisted by Tracy McKinn, who is at council table. This case involves an Indonesian helicopter accident that occurred in 2001 in bad weather in the mountains southwest of Jakarta, Indonesia. The aircraft was assembled in Indonesia by an Indonesian company. The crew was Indonesian. The owner of the helicopter was the Indonesian Forestry Department. The operator was an Indonesian company. And so it's not surprising that when the appellants came and filed the case in Fort Worth, that Bell moved to dismiss the case for form nonconvenience, and that the court did grant that motion. The case bounced back and forth, as Mr. Musselwhite alluded to, for a number of years because the plaintiffs really wanted to be in Fort Worth and have access to the American justice system. The first motion to reactivate kind of gave us a foreshadowing of how this case would be handled if it was reopened in Fort Worth. They filed that motion to reactivate in 2005, and it sat on file without being set for hearing for 2 years until 2007. Then the court sent it back to Indonesia. They refiled a motion to reactivate in 2009, and the court said, okay, let's just take the case and we'll litigate it here. Immediately upon getting the case here, Bell issued requests for production and other discovery requests upon plaintiffs to try to figure out what this case is about. That was 8 years after the accident at that point. Plaintiffs did not respond to those requests. Bell compelled. The court ordered the plaintiffs to respond. They still did not. And Bell filed another motion to compel and for sanctions, which is how we got to the hearing that resulted in the order that apparently is the basis of their appeal in July to August of 2010. So discovery had been ongoing for a year at that point in the case before we got to that hearing. But the plaintiffs had not advanced the case at all. Well, the plaintiffs did not want to be the only subject of discussion at the hearing, so they filed a motion to compel against Bell, attaching some deposition notices that were never served on Bell, asking the court to compel Bell to put up a number of witnesses on some broad topics.
Now, what did you mean by that? I mean, I looked at the certificate of conference, and of course, I left the clerk's record sitting in my office instead of bringing it in here, and it seemed to me that it indicated on maybe 9:30 that you were served with these, and then
they weren't
briefing. You said it was just a tab. I mean, what are you saying? It wasn't
right.
Served?
They were not served on us according to the rules
What does that mean?
They were not served on us at all, that we had those notices. I mean, they were served on us by an attachment to a motion to compel. That's how we got it.
Before that, you had never received those notices?
My memory is we never did get those notices, that they were first delivered to us attached to that motion to compel. That's my memory.
All right. And one of your objections was that the notices failed to comply with 199.2B, and I didn't see that. I mean, I assume what you're saying is, if an organization is named as a witness, a notice must describe the reasonable particularity of matters which examination is requested, and they said the person with the most knowledge of, which sounds exactly like what this is calling for. What was your complaint?
Well, we had a number of complaints on the various notices.
I understand.
For example, the most knowledgeable issue was an objection, like you just mentioned.
What's the objection?
The objection is the rule does not require you as an organization to put up a witness with the most knowledge. You have to put up a witness that's prepared to testify on the topic, and you can choose that witness. That was one of the objections. Because we must remember, this was 8 years ago at that point in time. And so people come and go at Bell. We may not have the person under our control had the most knowledge.
With that objection, what were the other objections?
The other objections were, for example, one of the notices asked for a witness on basically the entire design and manufacture of this model of helicopter.
Okay.
Things like that. There were the breadth of the notices was such that we couldn't properly prepare a witness to testify. And now we don't know.
Did the trial judge articulate the reason that he sustained your objections either in writing or at the hearing?
I don't believe he did. I believe that he just granted the motion to quash those specific deposition notices. And we had, as you alluded to earlier, the objection to how they were served and the methods and all that stuff. So it's possible he could have quashed them based on that. He did not say.
Is the hearing recorded?
I don't believe that we have a transcript.
Mr. Musselwhite indicated that he basically said at the hearing, as best his recollection was, I'm not going to let you take these depositions here. You need to go to Indonesia. And it seems to me that from reading these briefs, the thread that winds all the way through them is his lead dog argument about these depositions. So that's why I'm quizzing you about these depositions. That his position is I wasn't able to do discovery, which probably was mandamusable, but that didn't happen. So
we're right, and as Bell certainly requested a motion for protective order at that hearing, saying shield us from discovery. We're trying to get discovery from them. They won't give it
I
to
know,
us.
That was denied.
And that was denied. And that's in the same vein as what he's talking about, Mr. Musselwhite's talking about. And that and all other relief requested was denied in the order. The only relief that Bell was given was quashing those notices. The reason why we went to Indonesia is because, although they fought so hard to get the case here, then they turned around and said all the evidence is back over there. They said that they were unable to respond to our discovery request without going to Indonesia and taking depositions. So they said we have to go back over there. And in the FNC, as is often the case, plaintiffs say, well, we promise to pay the expenses of the other side if we have to go over there and get evidence. And the judge said, well, you're going to keep your promise and you're going to pay their expenses when you go back over there to get these depositions. And so it was at the request of the plaintiffs that we went to Indonesia to take those depositions. And it certainly wasn't the court was trying to impose that on them. And it was as of their promise that they had to pay for our expenses. Now,
did you not get some relief as to your motion to compel, at least as to written discovery?
The motions to compel previously had been granted already.
Okay.
And that's why we had moved for sanctions at that point. So there wasn't any additional relief. They were still ordered to produce.
Okay.
And so that was in August. And immediately, you know, we have a trial setting in November. And so Bell filed its no evidence motion for summary judgment shortly thereafter. And we came up for a motion for continuance, and that was continued. So they had a continuance. They asked for 9 months. The court gave them 9 months. And we were asking, when are we going to go to Indonesia? I got to get ready. I got to get visas. I got to get prepared. They were always asking for a little bit more time. They need a little bit more time. That's the way the case went on discovery throughout the 2.5 years. They need a little bit more time. And so we had a status conference. It was in the spring of 2011. And we said, Judge, we've got an upcoming trial setting. We still don't have depositions in Indonesia. We think you need to know about that. The judge gave him additional time for the new setting into November. And the discovery was still wide open. And still, They didn't get them set, and they didn't get them set. It wasn't until Bell reset its motion for summary judgment that had been on file for a year at that point that, okay, we're positions in Indonesia, and they sent them the last week of the discovery period. And so without a visa and without much notice, I got on an airplane and went to Indonesia, and I sat in a conference room in Jakarta and took the deposition of anyone who came through the door. If they would swear the oath, we took their deposition. So it didn't matter the order, didn't matter the identity. We were going to give them the opportunity to do depositions, and they did. And they used them in response to our summary judgment motion. What was unanimous by all of the witnesses was the wreckage was stolen by villagers because there was a lot of metal there, and they wanted to sell that. One of the witnesses testified that he saw a knife that someone made out of a metal component of the wreckage. No one said they saw Bell come in and take this wreckage away. Everyone said that the villagers had taken the wreckage. Now, they had recovered some wreckage, and one of the criticisms that the appellants make of Bell is that these depositions were delayed because Bell kept demanding that they get approvals of a bunch of governmental entities and things like that. That had nothing to do with the depositions. Bell steadfastly wanted the depositions to occur. We wanted to get the testimony of these witnesses. What they're talking about is a wreckage inspection. And that's a different sort of scenario. We determined that the government of Indonesia would allow us to take depositions and that we wouldn't be jailed for doing it. But when it comes to entering another person's property and taking a governmental entity's property and taking it with us and storing it and then manipulating it, we were not comfortable with that idea. And we did not want to subject our experts or counsel to incarceration for violating local law by interfering with someone else's personal property rights. So that's why we asked for certain, if we're going to do a wreckage inspection, we have to have approval of the property owner where the wreckage is, of the owner of the helicopter, so we don't want to just steal their property. But we could have taken these depositions at any time, because it's important for the court to recognize that although they waited 14 months to schedule them, when we got there and I sat there and waited for all the witnesses to come in, the people who came, by their own admission, were not subpoenaed. They were friends and family. They were people who came there on their own free will to testify. So it's not as if they had to do a lot of footwork or they didn't know what their own clients were going to say. These were the plaintiffs who were testifying. These were their friends. And so it's not justifiable to say it took 14 months to figure out and they had to wait to know what they were going to say until they got that testimony. They should have already known that. And that's the point of this, is that throughout the pendency of this case, and I mean no disrespect to Mr. Musselwhite, but the plaintiffs did not diligently pursue discovery in the case, and the trial court granted them multiple extensions of the trial date, and they had 2.5 years to prepare the case. That's just after it was reactivated. That's not when they knew they were supposed to be litigating it and they could get their own evidence together.
So they never took the deposition of anyone from Bell Helicopter?
No, that's not accurate. I know it's been said that way. But Mr. Musselwhite did allude to the deposition of a Bell witness in connection with the forum nonconvenience motion. And that witness was put up on basically the helicopter that's the subject. Bell's knowledge of it. It wasn't limited just to jurisdictional type of issues or contacts and convenience and all that stuff. It was about the helicopter, and that's how the plaintiffs know about the joint venture between the entities and things like that. There was testimony, and we produced documents. We produced drawings of the helicopter, and Bell produced its investigation file. See, the plaintiffs appellants have said that they needed depositions of Bell witnesses to know what investigation occurred and what wreckage Bell had in its possession. That was all known years before this summary judgment came up because Bell produced its investigation file, which had 4 pages of documents in it, some of them from the internet. Bell was not invited to participate in an investigation there, so we gave them what we had. They knew that we didn't have the wreckage because Minarno, who was a witness in Indonesia that Mr. Musselwhite referred to, gave a sworn statement that villagers had taken the wreckage approximately a year, maybe a year and a half before the MSJ and the depositions occurred.
So the investigation report you did provide them was not an on-the-ground investigation or inspection? are based upon that.
That's accurate. There, we did not have people that created an investigation report from the accident. We weren't invited to do that. The NTSC, which is the Indonesian version of the NTSB, did not do such an investigation either. They produced no report. And so there is no report. There are no maintenance. This is the issue that we have, is they can say that there's evidence of a gearbox problem. There's not. And in fact, they had their experts come on summary judgment and provide affidavits. Bell objected to those affidavits on a number of evidentiary grounds, and the court sustained those objections. But on appeal, they have not challenged any of those objections, and they have not briefed that issue. So there's really no evidence in the record to support their position on the summary judgment.
So the two affidavits that he referred the court to here today, the objections to those were sustained?
They were submitted twice. The first, Mr. Childers' affidavit, the first time it was submitted, all of our objections were sustained. And we attached that in the appendix to our brief. The second time, they attached it again, and then they had a new one, and there were sustained again, and then the court wrote in the objections that sustained and overruled. And that was for Mr. Sparks' affidavit, for Mr. I believe it was Mr. Wells' affidavit. So all these witnesses who came in and testified about what a bunch of other people who we can't find anymore told them, all those objections were sustained. And there were some that were overruled, and those were listed. So this is a classic situation where the plaintiffs did not diligently pursue discovery and did not even ask, they didn't ask again for those depositions of Bell witnesses in the 14 months that elapsed after the motion to quash was granted. 14 months, they didn't reissue notices. Unfortunately for them, they did not prepare their case for trial. After three trial settings, time was up, and I don't believe there's an abuse of discretion there in the court drawing the line after three trial settings. No evidence motion that was on file for a year came back up for hearing, and it was granted because they didn't have evidence. So we ask that the court decline the appellant's invitation to reverse the trial court's judgment. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. David. Mr. Musselwhite, rebuttal.
Well, I've been trying lawsuits a long time, and I've always found that I have to have a theory. I have to know where you're going. I have to know where I'm going on liability. And counsel knows that was a problem throughout. We didn't know that until we got to Indonesia. Perhaps I should be criticized for not going to Indonesia sooner. But if you read the affidavit of Rudy Irwin, you'll see why that was a very difficult job to go to Indonesia. And Mr. Irwin, he's got an affidavit that's not contradicted. He talks about all the problems they had, trying to satisfy counsel here to get those permissions from those three people to get the whatever wreckage there was in the ravine, and they finally got that out. It did not include the wreckage that we needed, which were those gearboxes. And so, and nobody's ever said that they saw the gearboxes. Nobody testified, hey, we saw somebody toting off the gearboxes and the transmission, and those matters that weigh 700 to 500 pounds apiece. Nobody testified to that. And we still think that, based on our experience in another lawsuit, which is in the record, where we had to file against Bell, had to file a motion for spoliation, and we finally got what we wanted, but only by filing a motion, we figured we'd have to file a motion in this case. The thing about the taking the time to respond, we didn't know where we were going. I'm being honest. I can't be anything but honest with the court. We finally found out where we were going three weeks before the trial was to start, before their hearing, and we asked the court to give us a short extension. And of course, as the court knows, the short extensions and continuances are favored in the law. If it's short and people are really trying to get ready for trial, the court could see we knew where we were trying to go. We're getting everything ready. We filed all of our papers that we had to file once we finished our trip in Indonesia, got them filed, asked for a little more time to get some other things done. We asked again to take the depositions of the defendants, and we were doing our dead level best to get ready to go to trial. We wanted to go to trial, and the court saw fit not to go ahead and cut it off at that point. I mean, our disappointment, very extreme disappointment, was that the time that all this time that we had winning the forum nonconvenience twice, he sent us back there twice, and doing all that we did to get into the United States, and then to go to spend the money for them and us and everybody to go get the depositions in Indonesia, find our theory of recovery, that seems to be a very good theory. And I just asked the court, and I'm sure you probably have, to read the affidavits of our expert, Arthur Childers, and I think you'll see that it makes sense. And what he says in his first affidavit explains why he can say that there was more than a scintilla of a fact that there was a product or defect or negligence of evidence based on what he saw and based on the testimonies that we got. And he said we only had friends testify. We had a person from the NTSC testify. That was not a friend. That was a person from the NTSC. Now, that was just not correct, counsel. And so we had other people testify there. And the point is, we were doing everything we could in our power. I think the court erred, and not willingly, willfully at all. The judge was always very good to us and very respectful. But I think he erred in cutting us off at the pass when we were there. We were at the pass, ready to go through and go to trial. Just we needed a few more days to beat, so we complied with the requirements of all the things you have to file to go to trial. And we had them all filed. We filed them, and he denied or refused to let us file any of those, and did not grant the continuous and granted the no evidence motion. And I think that was error. Because, and we say so, and I haven't argued that much, but if that can be found in the first affidavit of Mr. Childers, it goes into detail of what the evidence is, and I think the court, I would hope, would agree that that's at least a scintilla of evidence about liability. And certainly, we had other evidence we would hope to get together and get full and be ready to present to the court and to the jury when the trial would come, but we had all these things happening at once. And go back to the core of this. The core is that if you read Rudy Irwin's deposition, which is uncontradicted, I think I said this, if you read that deposition, you'll see, not written deposition, but affidavit, you'll see that how difficult it was to get these depositions set. I had to do it. I was the one responsible through my local council to get it done, and it was very difficult. Thank you for your time and effort, and I hope you'll look at this and read those affidavits, and I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Musselwhite, Mr. David, Ms. McKellen. We appreciate all of your arguments and, of course, all your briefing and preparation for today. Your case is now submitted. This being our last case for the morning docket, we will now adjourn.
All right.